Welcome to the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Today it is April 23rd. Joe Healy is joining me as always here. And we are going to today be exploring another one of our classic college baseball games that we are rewatching in this time of college baseball is spring. Joe has us going back into the archives and finding some great games to rewatch, or in many cases, watch for the first time for us. And then we bring on a guest who was a participant in that game to talk about them, to talk about the game and their team with us. Today, we are watching the 1992 College World Series Championship game between Pepperdine and Cal State Fullerton. And Steve Rodriguez, who was an All-American infielder for the Waves that year, will join us. Rodriguez is now, of course, the head coach at Baylor after a long stint as the head coach at his alma mater. So we're looking forward to that. But before we get to it, Joe, how are you doing on this kind of cloudy and a little dreary April afternoon?
Yeah, it is. Looking out the windows now, it kind of is alternating between just kind of the bright white cloud cover and kind of darker, more ominous cloud cover. I was able to get my daily walk in. Around lunchtime, I go and fun fact, I actually go walk laps like around the Baseball America office because I know nobody's going to be there. It's kind of an empty parking lot. So
except for the time that Josh ran into you there.
That did happen, yes.
Joe didn't even know that I knew that, but
I have. That's true. You guys have been watching me a little closer than I realize. Yeah, so I guess if any college baseball fans are out there in the Triangle area and you want to accost me while I'm on my – actually, don't do that. Just don't do that. we're doing the social distancing thing. But anyway, long story short, I got my walk in today. I was able to dodge the raindrops to get that in. I've been using that as a personal walking track, which has been kind of nice. I'm also heartened, by the way, on a different note. I thought about this as we've been using Zoom for these podcasts. We're getting these coaches on and using Zoom. And I am heartened that apparently we are better with technology than – NFL general managers and people that are putting on the NFL draft. There's been a lot of hand-wringing about whether or not that technology is going to work for the NFL draft. And so I guess what I've learned here is that Teddy and I should be running NFL franchises. I mean, that's really my only takeaway from the news of the last week or so. So congratulations, Teddy, on being qualified to do so.
Yeah, so, you know, we're recording this on Thursday and we won't release this episode until Friday. And so I really don't want to say something that I'm just going to regret in, you know, 15, 16 hours, but I do not understand what the NFL's issue is that they're struggling so hard in the week leading up to the draft to pull this draft off online. MLB's draft is entirely remote, literally every single year. They've been doing it that way for, as far as I know, ever. They don't have problems. I don't understand what is happening. And like, I do get some of this is probably a bandwidth issue because, you know, it's different to say that no one is in one central place. It's another thing to say like that your scouts and your GM and your owner and everyone has to have their internet functioning perfectly. But like, I really don't get it. I don't understand what's happening. And I would say I would find out tonight when we watch the draft, but I won't watch the draft, so I won't find out. And please, no one tell me. It's okay. So going from the football heavy talk that we started with, Joe, let's go to two schools that don't play football anymore, Pepperdine and Cal State Fullerton. They met in the 1992 College World Series final. Also Cal final, the second one of these games we've done. I don't know, if I didn't know better, I'd say Kyle was picking these games. Our colleague Kyle Glazer from SoCal, noted Southern California baseball enthusiast Kyle Glazer. But no, it is Joe that picks these games for us. And we're going to go back to Omaha in 1992, Pepperdine, Cal State Fullerton, and we're going to see a game, or we watched a game rather, that, you know, is very pitching heavy. You know, a nice clean game. We haven't had that all the time when we've been rewatching these games. This one, It helped that the wind was blowing in at Rosenblatt, but it was more of a pitching and defense kind of game with some, you know, nice big moments, some kind of key moments in the framework of, or moments that you see replayed in the framework of College World Series history. And this Pepperdine team certainly is one of the teams that gets looked back on a lot as a breakthrough team and for what it represented at the time and you know, the players that were involved. And, you know, I think beating Fullerton had a lot to do with that. But that's enough of an intro. Let's get to Steve Rodriguez, who played for that Pepperdine team and now is coaching at Baylor. Today on the Baseball America College podcast, we are delighted to be joined by Steve Rodriguez, current Baylor head coach and former Pepperdine All-American. And we are going to be talking about that 1992 championship game. But before we get to it, Coach, just it's been a strange time in the world and in college sports and baseball specifically. But how are you managing this baseball this spring?
or the lack thereof, right?
Yes.
You know, the biggest thing is, you know, I wish everybody could say, okay, this is how it's supposed to be handled. But we're in such a very unique time where obviously there's things that are unprecedented. We don't have a playbook for this. And, you know, when we FaceTime our players and we Zoom call them and just to kind of, the thing is, you know, we'll text and stuff like that, but I tell them, I go, I want to see your face, you know, just like all of us other, we like to communicate with people just by talking to them and seeing them. And I just want to make sure they're doing okay. Understanding that there are certain restrictions that the NCAA gives us and the things that we can and can't do. And so we're obviously abiding by that. But the biggest thing for me is I just want to see them and make sure they're doing okay and that they're healthy, that they're, you know, they're taking care of business in the classroom the way they're supposed to or in the virtual classroom. But, you know, for, I think for our coaches, it's just really difficult because, you know, our job is to coach. I don't know if I've ever spent a weekend at home in March or April. And, you know, you almost feel a little lost at times. I think at the beginning, for a lot of coaches, it was great to be able to connect with their families. And I just remember as a professional player, when I retired, getting ready for spring training, your body starts to, the clock starts to adjust and the anticipation starts to adjust. And then next thing you know, when you're not going to spring training or you've kind of been retired or released or whatever it is, then all of a sudden you start to kind of go, okay, there's something missing here and my body's not used to this. And so we're all just trying to figure out the best way we can.
Yeah, that's certainly the case here on our end. And I know for everyone around the country as well. Well, we're coping a little bit by watching old baseball games. So let's get to this 1992 classic here. And to set the stage, it was Pepperdine and Fullerton in the final. You guys had won the West Coast Conference. You got seated third in the West Regional. But you got through that pretty handily. And then once you got to Omaha, you didn't give up a run in the first two games. Then you beat Texas to advance to the final. At that time, I mean, you guys had only lost one game in the postseason. You guys must have been playing with a whole lot of confidence going into that final against Fullerton.
You know what's interesting about that? And I get these questions, I don't want to say quite a bit, but whenever somebody talks about back in 1992 during this time, during postseason, how different it was, I remind them, I go, we didn't have the internet and we didn't have ways of tracking other teams. You know, there was not a lot of games. Like if your game was on TV, it was like a really big deal, whether it was like, you know, Sports West or something like that. Like if you had a game on TV, it was a really big deal. And so we didn't, you know, we had Baseball America, you know, and that came out like once a month. And then the collegiate baseball, which, you know, is, you know, we got that every other month or something like that. And so by the time you had a chance to see everything that you wanted to see, it was already a month late. And so you just really had no idea about how good you were, how, like, what you were getting yourself into when you went to a regional, you know, scouting reports and all those different things. Like you can't really watch a lot. So you just really took care of yourself. And, you know, once the game started, you played how you were supposed to play.
Give us a sense of Fullerton's place at this time out, particularly within the frame of California, but just in general in college baseball. Augie at this point was a big name coach. He had recently returned from a few years he'd spent at Illinois. They'd won some national titles. I'm just curious how large they loomed as a program at this particular time on the West Coast.
Well, it was just interesting because I'll say they're a big program, but it's not like SC or UCLA where the school itself, you know, is just, it's a very prominent school on the West Coast. But for like us and Fullerton, we were kind of smaller schools in regards to a lot of things, like no football programs and stuff like that. But having played them throughout the year and then having to kind of match up with them in the national championship game was pretty fun, just because we knew a lot of the players, obviously, from playing against them already. But it was just really fun to be able to kind of keep that camaraderie and that banter going all the way to that national championship game.
So then you guys get started out there, and you guys got off to a really quick start. Fullerton had just played the night before in what the broadcast tells us, less than optimal weather conditions. You were a little bit more rested to get that 2-0 lead in the first inning. Just how important was that, and how much boost did that give you guys the rest of the way?
I'll tell you what, less than optimal conditions is a really funny way to put it. It was pouring. I mean, it was an outright downpour, and this is when Turfus became kind of a really big deal. They started using that, and they started putting that all over the field, and everybody was like, what are they putting on there? And it was this drying agent that we had kind of heard about, but not a lot of us could really afford, so we didn't really know much about it. You know, we had Diamond Dry, which was like the powder like substance, but this was like the Turfus where it's absorbing all this stuff, and they just poured bags upon bags upon bags on there, and it just did an unbelievable job. But it was absolutely pouring during that night game. And all of us, I just remember going, oh my gosh, I am so glad we're not playing in that right now.
And there's a play in the fourth inning specifically that I think maybe would get lost, you know, otherwise, but Scott Vollmer makes a play, your catcher, where he smothers a ball. Jeremy Carr is trying to take third base for Fullerton. At the time, Fullerton has guys on first and second with nobody out. He throws out Carr trying to get to third. Phil Nevin ends up hitting a single up the middle that would have scored a run. And of course, not to jump too far ahead, but you guys end up winning by one run. Right. How big of a piece of this puzzle was a guy like Scott Vollmer in that play within the confines of a game that, like I said, might get lost in the grand scheme of things?
All of those little things like that during that game were huge. You know, if Scotty doesn't come up and pick the ball up clean, or doesn't make the throw that he does, and you know, he's safe. Now, all of a sudden, you know, Phil Nevin's up with, you know, guys on, what is it, first and, or second and third, and, you know, and has a chance to kind of do some damage. And, you know, those are the things that I think, you know, everybody sees certain plays and certain hits and home runs, but those are the small things in games. And I even express that to our guys. Those are the little things that you look back and you go, if that would have gone this way, or the ability to make those small plays really allows a team to win a game like that. It really does.
I want to ask you another question about Scott Vollmer, too. I read an LA Times article in doing research for this interview about how he would bring a cooler to practice because he was trying to put on weight and he was worried about being a little bit skinny for the catcher position. Can you confirm this the presence of Scott Vollmer carrying a cooler to practice just to be constantly eating and drinking things?
Well, the funny thing about that is I just talked to Scott yesterday. So we have a great relationship and we stay in communication quite a bit. And I can confirm he was doing everything he could to put weight on. And even to today, he still doesn't have it on. You know, he's just that guy. But he would always do everything he could. He constantly had food with him trying to gain weight. But he was just one of those guys, he just couldn't do it. I know, rough for some people, that's a really rough thing, isn't it?
If we could all be so fortunate, I suppose.
Yes, exactly.
In the fifth inning then, Eric Ekdahl hits a home run. He hadn't hit one all season long. What were you guys thinking from the bench as you're watching that ball go out to left field?
You know what's – yeah, he didn't hit a home run all year. And I'm just going to let you know, the wind was blowing in at a pretty good clip from left field. And so when he hit it, I mean, he absolutely smashed that ball. And he hit it, and all of us were like, oh, my gosh, that's way out. And then all of a sudden you saw the ball start to die because of that wind. And we're like, oh my gosh, it's not going to get out. And I think it may have landed like in, you know, the second row or something, or it barely got out. And we were just like, oh my gosh. And even he, I think going around second base, he was kind of looking like, hey, what happened? Did it go out? Did it not go out? And he was trying to figure out, do I stop here? Am I out? But like when it went out and we knew he hit it, it was a great uplifting thing for our team, just because what a great opportunity to hit your first home run of the year.
In the middle of the fifth inning, Leslie Visser, the sideline reporter on the CBS broadcast, did a little bit on you about your superstitions you had going on at the time. Can you recall all the superstitions you kind of had going at that time? I'm curious if you're able to recount them all these years later.
You know, I'm pretty sure I had the same undershirt. There's certain things that, you know, I did. I'm trying to remember, like, there were certain ways I put on my batting gloves. There were certain ways I would go onto the field, touch a base. You know, like there was certain things I did, and obviously going through my professional career, those superstitions changed a little bit. But I could not recall every single one of them. But there was times where if I had a piece of gum in my mouth and I didn't get a hit, I'd spit it out, put another one in. I mean, there was all sorts of things I would do to try to give myself as much luck as possible. Do you guys know what they are? Because I would love to hear them.
I mean, that was that you covered the big ones there. They mentioned specifically the having to touch the base and jump over the line coming on and off. And one of the announcers mentioned a point where they watched you come off the field and you had not done your routine. So you got.
I forgot to do it and I had to go back and touch the base. I do remember that. I do remember that. That's
yeah, you covered most of them there. I was actually going to ask if you still have that undershirt.
Thankfully, no, and I'm sure my wife is very happy that that's not the case. I think when I left college, that left as well.
Yeah, they made kind of a big deal out of it, and I'm watching it, and they're talking about it, and I was like, I don't know. It seems like these aren't outlandish, but I guess when you combine them all together, maybe they seemed a little bit more out there.
You know, the funny thing about superstitions, or I just call them routines, is that it just gives you a sense of comfort. You know, that's all it is just that you're doing the same thing over and over again, and you're just allowing yourself to kind of remove some possible things that might be going on in your head that can give you a negative thought. So as long as you feel like you're doing consistently the same things over and over again, that's giving you success. You know, and I tell people, like, if you're doing it and you're having success, then keep doing it. I go, that's part of the success, is the routine of how you're going about your day and how you're playing. Now, you got to understand, like, if just because things don't go right doesn't mean that the routine has to change and all that other stuff. But I always think it's good to kind of create some kind of routine for yourself that takes your brain out of it a little bit.
Pat Ahearn was so good for you guys that day. What do you remember was working for him? What do you remember just about playing behind him on that day?
He was one of the most interesting guys to play behind, just because obviously the Oral Hershiser delivery and the mannerisms were to a T. I mean, he would sit there and practice that over and over and over again. And he was really, really good at it. But I've never seen a guy be able to handle like an 84 to 88 mile an hour fastball with as much sink as he had going on both sides of the plate. We knew that he was going to throw a bunch of strikes. We knew we were going to get a bunch of ground balls. But when he was starting to strike a lot of guys out, we knew we had a chance to be pretty good.
You make a play, obviously, that this is a big highlight in this game, is you make a diving play in the eighth inning. You know, team's in a little bit of a jam. It looks like Fullerton is in the process of putting together some sort of rally. They get a run, but you end up making what I guess could be described as a game-saving play on a dive to your left. How vivid do you remember that play specifically? And I'm curious, you know, how well you can remember kind of exactly what you were thinking and going through on that play.
I can remember like it was yesterday. I remember going to my left, diving for the ball. I think it was like about a 2 to 3 steps and then a dive. I remember being in the dirt completely. I didn't even get to the grass. I do remember kind of like all that turf is was on there at the time, and I remember it was pretty thick, and I hit a lot of it, and it came flying up. But I'll tell you what, it was one of the greatest things that I felt was when I turned to throw to first base, I could see our dugout start to come out as I was getting ready to throw, and that for me was like one of those, oh my gosh, that's really happening, you know, because as you're going through it, you're not thinking that this is a great play, this is going to be a game thing, you know, you're just trying to make the play. And so, but when I turned to throw it and all of a sudden I see our dugout kind of erupting out of the dugout onto the field, that's when I was like, oh my gosh, this is a really big deal. And then I throw the ball to first base and Dan Melendez, our first baseman, gives me like a fist pump. And first of all, that's like the most emotion you ever see out of him. He is very stoic, does not show a lot of emotion. And when he did that, I was like, holy smokes, like, we got a chance to win this thing right now.
Of course, I imagine that moment was only eclipsed for you by squeezing the final out on a pop-up in shallow right. Where does that rank for you just in terms of the memories you've made on a baseball field?
You know what was interesting about that play? First of all, it ranks unbelievably high because you almost go numb knowing that that has the opportunity to be the last out. And it felt like I ran about 80 yards going after that ball. And I kept going out after it, and then I backpedaled a little bit. And then I kept waiting for my right fielder, Matt McElreath, to call it all. I'm waiting for him to call me off, and he doesn't say anything. And then all of a sudden, I just wave my arms and go, hey, I got it. And I just remember, like, staring up at the sky for a long time, it felt like. In my feet, I just could not stay still, just waiting for that thing to come down. And then I was just hoping, okay, just make sure you catch this thing. So I used two hands to catch it, and I got it, and I was just like, oh, my gosh. And the funny thing is that that ball stayed in my glove and never came out until we got back to California.
Did you then end up at the bottom of the dog pile? Obviously, it's hard to see on the broadcast what happens after that. But what about the dog pile?
I was somewhere kind of in the middle. I don't want to say I was on the bottom because obviously I was way out in the outfield and I was kind of running in with the outfielders. So there was a lot of stuff happening before I actually got there. So I remember kind of hitting and kind of bouncing off and then trying to jump back on it at some point.
Well, so one of the strange things about that World Series is that that's one of the times where the player of the tournament, the most outstanding player, there it is, was a player on the losing team in the championship game. It went to Phil Nevin,
right,
who had an incredible season. He was the player of the year that year. But, you know, a lot of times maybe you would have wanted or someone, at least some wave would have wanted, and instead it was – it was Phil Nevin. What did you think in the moment when that got announced?
In the moment, I to be honest, I won a national championship. That's all. I was not concerned about who won. You know, afterwards, I had a lot of people say, I can't believe they gave it to somebody else. But he had an unbelievable World Series. You know, let's be honest. I had a couple, like, good moments. He had an amazing World Series. And the funny thing is, Phil and I'm coaching Phil's son on our team right now. And, you know, we have kind of flashbacks, and he tells people, he's like, you know what, it's really hard to put this, you know, player of the World Series trophy on my finger. He's like, it's great to have, but he's like, I'd rather have a national championship ring more than this trophy. But when you're a player that goes 1-1 in the draft and he has the World Series he does, I mean, I'm not foolish enough to think that, like, oh my gosh, we won, I deserve it. He did. He had an unbelievable World Series, and I thought he deserved it. It's just that simple. But I those are things I never look at and go, I can't believe I didn't get that. But all I do know is that we had a chance to win a national championship, and we did.
What's the relationship of this team like? You mentioned you keep in touch with some of them. Mark Wasikowski is, of course, in the coaching profession as well. How tight-knit is this group still?
It's pretty impressive. You know, Derek Wallace is a fireman in Florida. Dan Melendez is working in California. Scott Vollmer is a teacher in Southern California. Waz is obviously up in Oregon. You know, Jerry Ashoff, a left-handed pitcher for us, owns a bunch of restaurants in LA. You know, we actually stay in pretty good contact with each other. You know, whether it's through Facebook, text message, whatever it is, when something's going on with one of us, we don't have a problem with reaching out to just kind of remind people, hey, well, here's what something that's going on. We need to kind of keep this in our prayers or something like that. So, but I'll tell you what, it, you know, of the years, you know, the 6-7 years I played professionally, there's nothing that compares to the relationships that I have when I was in college. There's nothing that does it.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about Andy Lopez, and he's a coach that I think, this is just me saying, I think he's one of the more underrated coaches in the game when you consider that went to Omaha with 3 programs, won a national title at 2 programs. What did you pick up from him, and how can you see his influence in your coaching career today?
You know, it's the biggest thing is that he's an amazing Christian man, brought me to my faith. but was unbelievably aggressive in how he coached. And I mean that in just that he wasn't a big, you know, statistician like people are now. He wasn't all into technique and mechanics so much. It's just he wanted to push you to be the absolute best player you could be just on your own ability. And so he would just really have a way. And, you know, and obviously times have changed. You know, there's certain things that we can't do now as coaches that, you know, a lot of coaches got away with back in the day. But he just had an amazing way of motivating you to be the best you can be because that's what you're supposed to do. And he always made you feel like if you weren't doing that, then you were kind of short-sighting yourself and the team. And I really can't thank him enough for everything that he did for all of those guys. And I think just like every coach, some coach players are going to love him and some are not going to like him just because of, you know, they don't like how he talked or whatever it was. But when you have somebody who wants you to be the absolute best you can be and is going to push you to do that, you know, he might say some things that might be, I don't want to say hurtful, but motivating. That's all you're asking for from people is they want you to be the best you can be when you have your leaders. And he did just that. The fact that he had the success that he has had in all the different programs is not a surprise at all. He just did a phenomenal job when he had kids, pushing them to just be really, really good and to play really hard. And that was just as easy as I can make it.
You went back to Pepperdine once your playing career ended and you started your coaching career there. So obviously you spent a lot of time around that campus over mm-hmm. the course of your life. What does that place mean to you? And just did the view at that field ever, do you ever grow numb to it, or is it always like, oh, hey, there's the ocean?
You know, it is pretty awesome. There were times where you after practice or whatever it is, and you know, you're cleaning up, dragging or water in the field, and you kind of sit there and you go, oh man, this does not suck. It's pretty nice. And you're overlooking the ocean and just really taking it in, the fact that it's, you know, anywhere from 60 to 70 degrees year round. And, you know, you know, I met my wife there. I mean, we had an opportunity to coach there for a long time. And it's a special place for us in regards to like where we met and stuff like that in regards to our family. You know, we had a lot of success there on the baseball field. But the view, it just doesn't get old. And I remember when we went out to the regional last year at UCLA here with Baylor, we went over to Pepperdine and practiced, and our guys were looking at me like, this is where you were working? I was like, yep, this is it. And they're like, wow, what in the world were you thinking? And I was just like, well, you got to understand, we're at a pretty good spot where we are too. And they're like, no, absolutely, but coach, this is pretty nice. I was like, yeah, it is. I got it. So, but it was fun just to be able to take them back and kind of see kind of my old stomping grounds. It was fun to be able to do that with them.
So I was looking through your bio on the Baylor website today, and I found a little nugget towards the bottom that I wanted to ask you about. And that's that you won a baseball coaches cooking competition in 2010 and 2011 at the ESPN Zone in Anaheim. I would love to know what you cooked for that competition and what this was all about.
Okay. So if you want to, that actually happened for 3 straight years. Okay, and I am a big believer that I won the first year, but I did not get. So if you want to talk about trophies that I'm actually upset that I didn't win, that is the one. They at the ESPN Zone at Disneyland, they had this thing where there was a, you know, all the Southern California coaches would go there, and it was just different. You had to mimic what the chef made one time, and then you had to create your own pasta. So that was the one I actually did not win. But then there was another one where it was kind of like, hey, you have to make up your own sliders. And so they give you all the ingredients and you have to kind of make it up as you go. And so there was a couple different things, but I made a pasta dish that was actually really impressive. And then I made some sliders that were actually really, really good. And the funny thing about it is when I played professionally, I taught myself a couple different things during the off season. I never wanted to sit and just do nothing, because there's only so many swings you can take. There's only so many ground balls. There's only so much you can work out. And so I wanted to just be productive with my time. And so one off season, I taught myself how to cook. So I watched a bunch of cooking shows and I just learned a bunch of different things. And I taught myself how to make a pasta, taught myself how to make some meat and some gumbo and some other things. And trust me, I made some really, really bad dishes where we were calling pizza to be delivered often. My wife was like, oh, I cannot eat this. But I tell our guys, I said, you need to learn how to cook because it's something that you'll always be able to use. It's something that you can always be creative with. And it's always something that can, you can really pass some time with it. And so I did that one off season. I literally just every meal I wanted to learn how to cook and create something different and different flavors. And, you know, what did I like, what I, you know, what was really difficult and all these different things. And, you know, 1 year I became a personal trainer. 1 year I got into yoga, you know, 1 year I really got into running and diets. And so there was all sorts of different things that I would kind of get into for those 5 months in the off season while I was getting ready for Pro Bowl.
I love that. And the cooking skills are probably coming in very handy in our current situation.
Very handy. And what's funny, if you guys, my wife actually said this, and one of my players, because I usually make gumbo for our players like every year, I bring them all over to the house and I spend all day just making, you know, probably 8 pots of gumbo for them all to come and enjoy. And so she said, what you should do is like send out all that, like all the ingredients that all the players need and send it to them. And then just do like an Instagram live and just go ahead and record it and have everybody like kind of follow through and see what it does and see what it looks like. And I was like, wow, that's actually pretty interesting, because I've had some players literally ask me, hey coach, can you send me all the ingredients for your gumbo recipe? And then, you know, can you call me and walk me through it? And I'm like, absolutely. You know, and so those are just kind of fun things that I get to do with these guys that, you know, typically I probably wouldn't be able to do in other circumstances.
Yeah, cooking with Coach Rod that's an outstanding Instagram segment.
In the climate we're in, we're just trying to figure some things out, right?
Absolutely. Well, Coach, we really appreciate you taking the time to join us here on the Baseball America College podcast and to take this this trip back down memory lane with the 92 National Championship game.
No, I really appreciate you guys doing it. It's a great honor being able to win a national championship, but then be able to come back, you know, 28 years later and kind of revisit it and be able to talk about it and kind of bring back some of those emotions and that excitement and the memories that we had at that time was really, really special. And I know with college baseball being put on hold for a little bit, it makes it difficult for you guys, but I just want to thank you for allowing this opportunity to happen and being creative enough to allow me to be a part of it.
All credit goes to Joe. He is, he was the creative, or he was the creator of this this series, and I'm enjoying it. I know Joe's enjoying it, and hopefully all of our listeners and all of our guests are enjoying it as well. So we really appreciate it, and you know, we have fun watching these games.
I'm sure that's got to be awesome.
Thank you again to Steve Rodriguez for joining us here on the Baseball America College podcast. So Joe, we had a thrilling game. And, you know, Coach Rodriguez helped walk us through that. What kind of were your impressions of the way that of the game when you were watching and then of what Steve was able to bring further light to?
Yeah, kind of as I was watching this game, it kind of felt like what you assume West Coast baseball is all about. It was well pitched, but it was well pitched in a specific way. And I mentioned this in our notes. We have a little notes document we create with questions for our guests and all that. And one of the little notes I made for a question was that, you know, Pat Ahern, the starter for Pepperdine, throws a really good game, but he wasn't really striking folks out. You know, he wasn't throwing hard. He wasn't, you know, wasn't flashing big time stuff in any way, but his numbers were really good that year. And he continued it with his performance there. And, you know, it was on the Fullerton side. I mean, they just get one inning out of their starter Nolte, and you know, they go to the bullpen right after that, and their guys did a really good job, kind of in the same way. So it wasn't the type of pitching performance where you're going to come away just blown away by what you saw, but it was, you know, it got the job done. And it reminded me a lot of kind of what we saw with Ted Silva when we talked about his performance for 95 Fullerton in our first episode in this series, where, you know, and his was a little different in that he got hit around early in that game, but his successful innings were kind of similar to what we saw from Ahern, where it was a lot of ground balls. And, you know, Coach Rod mentioned Ahern throwing a lot of strikes. And actually in this game, at one point they show a graphic and he threw 95 pitches, 50 strikes, 45 balls. But I don't remember, and I'm not looking at a stat line here, but I don't remember him walking a lot of guys, if any, you know. So he was clearly just doing a good job of working the ball in and out and up and down and enticing Fullerton to into weak contact. And I would really have to go through another watch and examine to really think about, well, is Fullerton a little over aggressive here? Are they pressing a little bit? I didn't get that sense during the game, but certainly you could see that given that given the way Ahern was performing. And the thing that I came away with when Coach Rod was talking, and he alluded to it a little bit, but you just got the feeling in watching this game and hearing the way this team has talked about that it is a special group. I mean, from a big picture perspective, I think it's special because it's an underdog national champion. Now, Pepperdine is an underdog national champion in 92 in the same way that Coastal was in 16, in that it's a program from outside of the traditional power structure, but at the same time, a program that's really successful, but still an underdog national champion. And so I think that's part of it, but it's also just that this was a really special group. I mean, this is a talented group, even for Pepperdine at the time, had a lot of guys drafted, a lot of guys that were pro prospects, a lot of guys that weren't, sure. But you get the feeling it's a close-knit group. It's a group that's still involved in baseball. I mean, to have two sitting head coaches on the same team is pretty special. I'm sure there are plenty of other examples, but this one really stands out, and I think that's part of the reason why this team continues to live on in college baseball lore for sure. So I enjoyed watching it for getting to see guys like Coach Rod and Coach Waz, just to kind of compare that to the guys that I know now in coaching. And I enjoyed it too, just because it is so much of that, like we talked about in the last episode leading up to this, it is so much just a trend. I'm losing my words here, but it is such a transformational championship for a Pepperdine program that had been on the cusp for a while and finally got over the hump.
So I think that's all right. You know, the just the way that they were perceived at the time. And, you know, I wonder what it must have been like to have these two programs that are so kind of far aflung from traditional college athletics powers to be playing for the national title. You know, it's one thing when Fresno State plays Georgia, or when Coastal, plays against Arizona. It seems like it's quite another when Fullerton plays against Pepperdine. And, you know, if that happened today, you know, what would that be like? How much would that be decried in terms of ratings? Would that be bad for ratings? I don't know. These are all interesting things that you didn't have to worry about in 1992. You could focus more on the matchup. And I just think that's cool that that happened. I know they, I don't know how much they got into it on the broadcast or if it was something I read, but just talking about how good it was for California. I guess it was Augie was saying, you know, they beat Miami in Ron Frazier's last game to advance to the finals. And, you know, they're talking about, Augie was talking about how he kind of wished they could have just given it to Miami to let Ron Frazier go at it one more time, but that this would be really cool for California baseball. And it's, I'm sure that must have been, you know, to have, you know, these two SoCal teams, a lot of the players knowing each other, and, you know, them, it not include USC or UCLA. You know, that it's a very different thing than what you normally see in a championship event. So from that aspect, I think it was pretty interesting. I also found it very interesting just to kind of compare how different the game was then to now, and not in a lot of the obvious ways we've talked about already, but like, this game opens with Mark Wasikowski trucking a catcher to end the first inning and getting tagged out in a controversial call. He may have touched home plate on his way from getting flipped over the catcher. And, you know, they're talking about, you know, Greg Gumbel and Jim Cotter talking about how the catcher has the right to be there. The ball's like almost there. Well, the ball wasn't actually there yet. So he's blocking the plate without the ball, which pretty soon would be outlawed. And then of course later, you know, now you can't run into the catcher regardless. And if the catcher's in your way, like, you have to work around that and like to trust that the right call will be made. But like that play, you don't see that anymore in college baseball.
Yeah, not at all. I actually had the same thought there, that that was a way. And we've talked about a lot of ways in which the game is different, especially at the college level now versus then. And that's one way we hadn't touched on. It's this World Series, actually, I hadn't realized this at the time, I think, but since then I've learned that this particular World Series was transitional in a different way, because I believe the 92 College World Series is the last one we have that does not include an SEC team.
That is what Wikipedia told me.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, so in that way, I mean, if you really want to talk like macro topics and how this College World Series in this period of time more generally is kind of the end of an era and ushers in a new era. And I think largely we have LSU to thank for that, you know, because this was really LSU under Skip Bertman really getting rolling and getting going for winning national titles in the way that they were. So that, I think, ushers in a new era as much as anything else. But certainly you can see kind of the winds of college baseball shifting a little bit there with the SEC becoming what they are. And you and I had this conversation before. You talked about it's, you know, these are two schools that Fullerton, I believe, had either just cut football or would soon thereafter cut football, and Pepperdine didn't have it at all at that point. And so that's unique. And you and I have had this conversation. Actually, we've kind of expanded it to talk about a program like Rice that just kind of rose up from the ashes, essentially, if that kind of thing is even possible now. And that's a topic for another day. And you and I have talked about a million different ideas around that topic. But I think that's another way. This is another example of a thing that maybe couldn't happen in today's college baseball in the same way. These two programs that just are, in the grand scheme of things, in the big college athletic scheme of things, smaller programs, smaller schools. And Coach Rod talked about that in the interview. You just wonder if this kind of thing, whatever the 2020, 2021 version of this is, if that's even really something that's possible today in college baseball. And I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to imagine that's for sure. It's hard to imagine. You know, I mean, we see Big West teams get to Omaha. We haven't seen them win a whole lot of games recently. So it's not hard to imagine Fullerton getting back to the stage, or a UCSB or Long Beach. I couldn't tell you the last time a West Coast Conference school made it. It's been a long time. It's not to say it couldn't happen, but to see those two things happening together, you know, and it doesn't mean that it has to be you know, West Coast Conference in a Big West school. You know, if you got, a Big East school without football, but I mean, even the Big East is different because, you know, these are big brands in the Big East. That's a major conference in a lot of respects in basketball, at least, you know, maybe not so in baseball, but yeah, I mean, to get that kind of thing happening, it's hard to imagine. And I mean, it's not like it was happening all the time back then either, but obviously it did happen. And, you know, you had Phil Nevin, the best player in the country, playing for Fullerton. Steve Rodriguez was a first round pick himself, playing for Pepperdine. And there were other very talented players on the field that day. And you just generally don't see that kind of talent distribution away from the major power structure in 2020. So that is definitely something to think about. Another thing that we've left behind is that Kevin Costner sent a fax to Fullerton the night before the championship game to will them on or to congratulate them for making it that far, whatever the fax was. But I apologize for not writing down what he said. I was a little stunned by A, that he sent a fax, and then B, that Fullerton is wearing a patch with Kevin Costner's initials on it in this season. They did not explain that well enough.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't noticed the patch. Maybe I noticed it and didn't make the connection there. But yeah, maybe he had made a donation of some sort. I mean, maybe that's what I don't know. But I'd kind of forgotten that Kevin Costner is a Fullerton baseball super fan. I had known that at some points because he would, and I remember this, I guess this would have been maybe like the George Horton days at Fullerton. Maybe it was Dave's years at Fullerton, but I do remember seeing him at like super regional games at Fullerton. The ESPN cameras would cut and there's Kevin Costner at the Fullerton baseball game. So he is very much a fan. Maybe it started when Augie was there because, you know, Augie's a kind of a magnetic personality that it kind of brings people in. And so that probably is where it started a little bit, but then, you know, once he was in, and so He was definitely, it wasn't just a one-time deal for Kevin Costner. He's a guy who's been around that program quite a bit and has stuck with it. So he supported the program in years in which they were not wearing a patch with his initials on it.
Yeah, the full story of that is one that's escaping me right now a little bit, but I know it's in Augie's book, which means it's out there in other formats. So if you're curious, you can do a little Googling and figure that out. It's he went there obviously, and at some point he met Augie, and a friendship was formed. And Kevin Costner loves baseball, of course, so it all came about pretty organically and naturally. But it was an interesting part of the telecast. I also, you know, we hear a lot of times fans complaining that a broadcast is slanted one way or another, but like I watched a lot of this thinking, like, are they going to talk about Pepperdine ever? Like, when is Andy Lopez's little video hit going to come up? Like, we've had like three from Augie, and you know, for all I know, Andy Lopez didn't want to do it, but it was interesting just how famous Fullerton was at the time, how famous Augie was at the time, and how, you know, Pepperdine is like very much in an underdog and you know, status, and you know, it was deserved. You know, they were just a three seed in the West Regional, I guess, and you know, they certainly didn't have the national titles that Fullerton did, and you know, it was interesting that you know, even in 92, you know, that's multiple Fullerton national titles ago, they had you know, they still were already, you know, this big powerhouse, at least in relative to Pepperdine.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, like, you and I have been at the CWS media day, which is like the day before everything starts, and when they're like pulling players up to do their little pre-recorded hits, and you know, on those backdrops to get run on the big screen, and so that gets kind of, all that stuff kind of gets taken care of then. And I just wonder if that was as much a function of anything else. And I think this kind of hammers home the point of Pepperdine is, even in that world in 1992, being an underdog, that you just wonder if CBS or whoever was producing those pre-recorded pieces was just kind of like, well, they probably did something with Miami, you know, for Frazier, and then, oh, we'll do something with Augie because we know Augie, he's been here, and you know, those are, you know, two of the favorites here, and then that was all they did, and maybe that was all they anticipated needing, or I don't know. But you could definitely see it being a matter of limited time and resources, especially back then at the College World Series, and so they just kind of grabbed the folks they knew were good quotes and would be most likely go deep in the tournament, and that's how that ends up being the case. But obviously we'll never know.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if they even did as much stuff like that back then, or if it was just a function of like you know, Pepperdine played the early game the day before, and you know, then like Andy Lopez got busy doing other stuff. You know, who knows? But it was interesting just to see how much there was about the Fullerton stuff and how little there was coming out from the other end. And it was distinct, at least in my eyes.
It's interesting too. Remember how it may have been when we were talking about the 95 game, but you know, we kind of had that brief discussion about, was the CWS champion national title game a bigger deal back in the CBS days? And we kind of landed on, well, like, yes and no, and here's why. But this is 92, so a few years before that, and it was kind of jarring to me that, you know, Steve Rodriguez catches the pop-up, Pepperdine celebrates, commercial, they come back, they interview Andy Lopez, Steve Rodriguez, and Eric Ekdahl after the game, holding, you know, the championship t-shirts, and then they go to commercial, and I kind of expected them to come back to do, like, you know, just one more. I didn't expect like a 30-minute post-game show, but I expected them to come back for one more, like a couple of sweeping crowd shots, a shot of the dog pile, like maybe some analysis from the booth by Jim Cott and Gumbel. But nope, they went straight to the LPGA tournament they were covering that day. So it was just very jarring that, oh, okay, so yeah, maybe this was a little bit of a big deal to be on CBS, but certainly that's something you really can't imagine today. Now, granted, the internet and being able to do post-game shows that are streamed versus on actual broadcast networks has changed the game a little bit there, but it was just kind of jarring to me that in 1992, you know, that the game wraps up, they do one quick interview, and then that's it, folks, for the College Baseball National Championship and how far we've come.
It also struck me that, like, Andy Lopez is doing his best Nick Saban. Like, did he smile in his post-game interview? Like, here he is having won the national championship. And yeah, it was a staid bunch there, or a reserved bunch, I should say, having won the national championship. One more thing I wanted to touch on here is that the Ahern comps to Oral Hershiser, like, exist everywhere if you read anything or watch any of this game. About the 92 Pepperdine team, they are all over the place. And Joe, as someone who really has no connection to where Oral Hershiser ever pitched, what do you make of that? Because it's like, you will still hear it out there. Griffin Canning got slapped with that a lot. I mean, it helps that Griffin Canning's wearing his number, but like, that's a thing that, you know, Oral Hershiser is kind of this, in some ways, mythic/cult hero still in Los Angeles. And, you know, I grew up in Cleveland. Oral Hershiser finished his career there, and like, I don't know, like, no one in Cleveland really thought that much. Like, it was cool that he was there, I guess, but I feel like people were more excited about Dennis Martinez coming than they were about Oral. Maybe that's just me misremembering, but you know, it's been interesting as I've seen more of this over the years, just how much Oral Hershiser means to a certain kind of pitcher out in that area, especially.
Yeah, I think it's probably because I'm with you. I don't remember him as being the pitcher that he really was, but just a quick look at like his baseball reference page will reveal, you know, he won a Cy Young in 1988, but he also came in third in the Cy Young in 85, fourth in the Cy Young in 87, and fourth in the Cy Young in 89. And so, I mean, there really was a run where he was as good as anybody in baseball on the mound, at least. And so I think that's probably just a matter of you and I having not really, obviously, had literally not been around for most of that. And then just the fact that he is kind of, I think, more of a cult hero out in LA and for the hardcore Dodger fans and West Coast baseball fans, more so than an actual big name star in the grand scheme of baseball at large. I think every city has these, but I'm like you, I'm not really sure. Maybe it's by comparing him to Oral Hershiser, I think now with Ahern, like the motion was definitely almost like a dead ringer in terms of his actual mechanics. But I think more largely the comps to Oral Hershiser are maybe just for a specific type of pitcher that.
Yeah, the bulldog is definitely the
right
bulldog location over velocity. Like that's a big part of it for sure.
Right. And maybe even to some degree, just the way that the pitcher carries himself, I think can play into that. So I almost think, I don't know if this makes any sense, but pitchers that don't fit a very narrow group of characteristics that don't obviously fit in some other box end up getting the Oral Hershiser comp. And maybe it's just really convenient out in LA to do that. So I don't know. I think it's a really good question. It's a good observation. I hadn't really thought much of it, although I did notice how often it was mentioned that he was an Oral Hershiser lookalike, because I too did a Google search for Pat Ahern and it was everywhere. So, I think that's a really interesting observation. I hadn't given it much of a second thought, to be honest.
All right, one more. I loved, and then we can talk about Steve Rodriguez and cooking. But I love that, like, he took their, you know, when they're back out, that they had their regional at UCLA last year, they practice at Pepperdine, and his own players at Baylor are like, why did you leave the ocean? The ocean's right there. Like, I love that.
Yeah,
that's just how good Malibu is.
It is, and I can tell you firsthand now, having been there a little more than a month ago now, it was pretty incredible, honestly. I mean, the drive up there from LA is great, and so there's a lot going for it. And I think, I mean, let's be honest, when I think to a neutral observer who kind of casually follows college baseball, and you know Pepperdine, and thanks in large part to this 92 national championship, by the way, you know Pepperdine as a name in college baseball, and Baylor is also a name in college baseball. Like, let's be clear about that. But you know, so I think it's easy to look at what Pepperdine has done and what Baylor has done, and Baylor hasn't won a national title, so I guess Pepperdine has that over them. And then you see Malibu, and then you see Waco, Texas, which is not Malibu. I mean, I'm a Texan, so obviously, you know, I'm inclined to give the benefit of the doubt to places in Texas, but Waco is not Malibu. And so I think there were a lot of people when he moved to Baylor that kind of had a similar thought process, like, really, you're going to give up what you've got out there on the West Coast and come to Waco. And by the way, you're going to follow the guy who really made Baylor into what they are in Steve Smith. And that's always kind of a hard thing to do. So, but I think that just goes back to the fact, I think we brought this up in a different way in the last episode, but you know, different coaches value different things. And sometimes there are reasons for making a move that aren't obvious on the surface. And Pepperdine has its limitations. I mean, stadium still doesn't have lights and you're in the West Coast Conference versus the Big 12. And so that there's an inequity there. And there are just, you know, a lot of things that aren't maybe on the surface that would seem like reasons to, there are a lot of reasons it would seem like you'd want to stay out in some place like Malibu that when you dig a little bit deeper, you know, it stacks up in favor of Baylor. So it was just one of those things where I think there were a lot of head scratches. I think it's similar when our friend Dave went from, you know, out on the West Coast at Fullerton to Tennessee. You know, I think there were a lot of similar questions being asked about why that move would be made, but it was another one where there were some things in those major conferences. There are just some things that can't be provided at locations, even good programs in conferences that just aren't as big. And so we've kind of backed our way into circling around to the conversation we were just having about how hard it is to be a team in one of those conferences and do what Fullerton and Pepperdine have done.
Absolutely. I certainly was among those that were looking at the Pepperdine to Baylor move and trying to like see if there were connections that could be drawn, but it has worked out very well for Coach Rodriguez and for the Bears. I do want to touch on the cooking element of this whole thing. I love the idea that he is most upset about not winning, or that he is very upset about not winning the first cook-off at the ESPN Zone. Pour one out for the ESPN Zone. I'm sure that doesn't exist anymore. And then that he is like willing to walk his players through making his signature gumbo. I mean, I love all parts of that.
Yeah, I was really, you know, you never know what you're going to get when you ask a question like that. I was really pleased by his response. It was, you know, he had a great answer prepared. I think it's, he made a larger point there that I think is good, which is cooking is a skill. And I think that's something that, you know, he learned when he's off in pro ball. But I think coaches talk a lot about getting their players prepared for pro baseball. In a lot of ways, they talk about the, not just the on-field stuff, but off-field stuff like managing money and things like that. But I think cooking is one thing that might get overlooked in a lot of cases. So I think it's actually really great that he kind of impresses that upon his players that, you know, you're going to have time on your hands in pro ball or just in life. I mean, you get into your first job and you're on your own really for the first time and you've got your own money to spend and how do you spend it and how do you, you know, kind of feed yourself. And that's something they don't really teach you typically. And so I think that's actually really smart by Coach Rod to make that part of, you know, what he's trying to teach his players. And I can also see that, you know, in pro baseball, his point about you don't just want to spend time sitting around. And so he took it upon himself to pick up some hobbies along the way. And I can imagine I'm kind of a fidgety person by nature. I think had I been in his shoes, I probably would have been doing something similar.
All right. So that was the 1992 College World Series championship game. That was our interview with Steve Rodriguez. We covered a lot of ground from his playing days at Pepperdine to his cooking days, also at Pepperdine, and everything in between. So we really want to thank Coach Rodriguez for coming on the podcast. Joe, it is time for us to select a game for next week's podcast. So why don't you tell the listeners what we're going to be watching if they want to watch the game before next Friday's podcast.
Yeah, we're going to go all the way back to 2011. Excited to watch a game from this era because this is an era we haven't really touched on yet. We've done some very recent games, I guess specifically the Oxford regional game between Tennessee Tech and Ole Miss, and we've primarily done older games. And so this will be kind of nice to go to an era of game that we haven't really done, which is almost smack right in the in the middle of that, we are going to be doing the 2011 College World Series game between South Carolina and Virginia. This was the second of the two games they played in that College World Series. This one goes into extras, so buckle up and get comfortable. It is a lengthy one, but it's the this is obviously in the midst of South Carolina's incredible run through the postseason, led by Michael Roth and Matt Price in the back of the bullpen. Jackie Bradley Jr. was a part of those teams. Just a really fun time in South Carolina baseball history, a really successful time, obviously, in South Carolina baseball history. So I'm looking forward to going back and kind of revisiting those teams that I was very much aware of. I was following along. So these are this is a game I have seen for sure. I have not rewatched, though, so it'll be a fun rewatch for me of a game, believe it or not, almost 10 years ago. This is another game, by the way. The recording is kind of wonky, so just bear with it. Again, watchable just like the 92 game. But looking forward to it. I think these are this era of college baseball was an interesting one because they had just – they just changed to the BB Corps bats. Everyone was kind of getting used to that. And it was interesting that South Carolina was just able to roll with that. And they just kept on winning. And that dynasty continued, which a lot of other programs would not have been able to do that. It just shows you how they were really built to win under any circumstances. So South Carolina fans will enjoy this rewatch. I think just general college baseball fans will as well, just realizing how great that run of South Carolina baseball was.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. This actually is the year that I was an intern at Baseball America. So, fun little personal aside there. And yeah, it's an exciting game from what I remember. I don't remember the entirety of it. Full disclosure, Joe and I just looked at the box score and we both were like, wait, why did that happen? So we clearly need the refresher. And we're looking forward to getting it. So yeah, check that out. You can watch it on YouTube. And like Joe said, it is linked over at baseballamerica.com. You just have to find his 10 great college baseball games you can watch on YouTube, part two. And it is within that piece. So we will be back here on the Baseball America College podcast talking about that next week. We will have a guest. We do not yet have the guests lined up. So once we do that, we will let you know who it is. We believe, again, we know who it is, but it's not fully iced. So we'll let you know when we know. We also will be back here on the Baseball America College podcast on Tuesday. We are going to do our news year show. Again, we are going two times a week throughout this spring. First episode of the week drops on Tuesdays. It's the News Year show. Second episode of the week drops on Friday. It's us rewatching a game, following along in that series. So we'll be back here on Tuesday with our News Year show. If you want to tune in and catch up on all of the goings on around college baseball, we'll be here in your podcast feed then. Until then, you can check out plenty of stuff over at baseballamerica.com. We'll have a new top 25 on Monday as we continue to rank 25 things throughout the course over the course of the next several months. We are committed to doing that until we have a chance to rank 25 teams again next preseason. We're very much looking forward to that, but we're also enjoying these, diving back into the history books a little bit or whatever it is. This week's was the 25 best Golden Spikes seasons of all time. And that was a fun one. So hopefully you check that out if you have already. So we have plenty of content over there on the website to keep you guys busy, hopefully in this baseball of spring. We're doing our best and we appreciate everyone who is clicking on the links and reading and listening and subscribing to the podcast and doing all of those good things. You can follow us on Twitter. I am at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy BA. We will be back here, like I mentioned, next week on the Baseball America podcast. Until then, I want to thank you guys for listening. Thanks again to Steve Rodriguez for joining us here today. Thanks to Joe. I've been Teddy Cahill. We'll talk to you next week.